It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Later in the program, we'll talk about how bomb-sniffing dogs are trained and why they are in high demand. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, the public's getting a chance to sound off today on a proposed bill that would close up to 4,000 acres of forest around a proposed mine site in northern Wisconsin.
The authors of the bill say the measures needed to protect workers at Cogebic Taconite from protests. But others are calling it an overreach, saying it would unnecessarily close off thousands of acres of land that isn't actually being considered for mining.
Sean Johnson joins us now with the latest from the public hearing. He's WPR state government reporter. And Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what exactly was this hearing about today?
So this is a hearing on the bill that you mentioned that would close off about 3,500 acres, it sounds like, that's in the managed forest land program surrounding the proposed site where this mine would be in northern Wisconsin. And right now, if a landowner has land in the managed forest land program, they get a big property tax benefit out of that if they keep it open to the public. And if they want to close it to the public, they want to take it out of the managed forest land program, they got to pay a tax penalty. This bill would change that. They would no longer have to pay that tax penalty to take it out of the open status for this program. And for GTAC, the mining company, they've said that they want to do this because of an incident that happened in June where several people were videotaped shouting obscenities, threats, and taking a woman's camera at the site of one of the test drills.
And so if this were to pass, this proposed bill, how long would this forest stay closed to hikers and other people who want to use the land recreationally?
Couldn't get a really firm answer on that today, but Senator Tom Tiffany, the Republican who's sponsoring this, said yesterday it could be about 3 years. There was some talk in the committee hearing today that it could be 3 to 5 years. And I think it's important to note that if this bill passed as it's written, it would happen automatically as soon as a company files an intent to seek a permit. From when a permit decision is reached, this law would automatically close off this section of land, and so it would be it could be reopened for certain activities. Could be reopened for deer hunting or a variety of other activities. But whether that happened would be completely up to the mining company, GTAC, and the DNR. So in essence, it gives the mining company veto power over whether or not to do that.
Now, the bill, as I understand it, is specific to this mine site. Is that right?
Yeah. So it wouldn't affect other areas of the state, the other thousands of acres throughout Wisconsin that are part of the managed forest land program that are getting this, property tax, reduced property taxes by keeping the land open. It would be specific to this site. And so, while it in nowhere in the bill mentions this particular mine or the mining company, it's definitely a bill written with them in mind.
Now, you talked a little bit about what caused this bill to be proposed, about the protest and some of the behavior that was going on there. What are opponents to the bill saying?
Well, opponents are saying that it's a special, kind of a special handout to one company at the expense of other property taxpayers in that area. So, that's a point that Senator Bob Jauch, whose district includes the mine, made repeatedly at the public hearing today. He said there is a way for the mining company to close this private property down, take it out of the open status through the managed forest land program, pay the tax penalty like other businesses would have to do, and then you can post it, you can keep everybody off. There would be no issues. And so they're saying what you're going to end up doing is take this land that people have hunted on for many years. You're going to very quickly potentially close it down later this year, maybe in October. And then you'd have people going up there who used to hunt there, not knowing that it's closed, potentially trespassing, or people going up there not sure what's happening and just avoiding the area. The company says, though, for them to pay that tax penalty to take the to close it down, they feel like that'd be unfair because they'd be giving in to the protesters who raided the mining site in early June. They feel like they'd be having to pay a monetary penalty for something that they didn't bring on.
So you were at the hearing today about the consideration for this bill. What did you hear today? What were people saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a very long back and forth between the author, Senator Tom Tiffany, and Senator Bob Jauch, the Democrat mentioned earlier, who represents that area. So it wasn't the type of hearing that where you might expect members of the public pouring in and people speaking for a few minutes at a time. It was a very long back and forth between them. And it was a lot of Senator Bob Jauch trying to pin down Senator Tom Tiffany and the motivations of the bill, who would benefit, trying to pin down the representative or the spokesman for the mining company, GTAC, on exactly what their plans are, because GTAC could open up parts of this land for hunting or fishing, things like that. But, that's not spelled out in the bill. So a pretty contentious hearing along those lines. You did hear from a couple conservation groups that said, we don't want you to do this. This runs contrary to our members' best interest. And then you heard the mining company saying, we need this to happen if we're going to have a successful business up there.
Do you have a sense about whether there are other landowners who could look at this bill and say, I would like to close down, I'd like an exemption too, and this could be applied more broadly down the road?
Yeah, I mean, well, they're definitely out there. I don't know that it would be applied more broadly down the road, but there are landowners out there, I know, who said, I have land that's in the Managed Forest Land Program. If I want to take it out, I have to follow these rules. If it's over a certain acreage, I have to pay this tax or this fee to get it out of the Managed Forest Land Program. Why is this one situation getting special treatment? I don't know that it would be applied elsewhere down the road, though.
So can you give us a sense of what is next for this bill, what we can expect?
Well, this is a bill that we actually didn't know about until last week. It was introduced, I believe, on Friday before Labor Day weekend, given its first hearing today. The committee's planning to vote on it tomorrow. So, at least through the committee process in the Senate, it's on what you'd normally call the fast track in the legislature. Whether or not the legislature is going to move on it that quickly, we don't know yet. It doesn't sound like the state assembly is going to be until October, so it's not like this thing is going to become law and be on the governor's desk overnight. But Senator Tiffany, the author, chairs this committee. He wants to move on it fast on his end.
All right. Well, Sean, thank you so much for being here today. We're going to keep watching this one, as I'm sure you will too.
All right. Thank you.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter.
Coming up next, a look at the life and training of a bomb-sniffing dog. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
In the post-9/11 world, the use of bomb-sniffing dogs has skyrocketed.
Thousands of canines, mainly German Shepherds and Labradors, have been deployed in airports, banks, and on the battlefield.
Writer Joshua Levine recently explored what life is like for a bomb-sniffing dog by meeting these dogs and the people who train them.
Joshua wrote a piece in Smithsonian Magazine called The Education of a Bomb Dog. He joins us now. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
So who trains bomb dogs? Who's out there doing this?
Well, there are a couple of, I guess you might call them colleges or graduate schools for bomb dogs. I focused on one that, if not the biggest, is certainly one of the biggest, concentrated in the Northeast. The name is MSA Security. And given the growth in the use of bomb dogs, they're doing extremely well.
I bet. Now, why dogs in particular? Why are they such good bomb sniffers?
Well, it's not, as I say in the piece, that dogs smell particularly better than all other animals, although they smell extremely well and certainly a hell of a lot better than humans. But it's a combination of how well they smell, how well they can be trained, and their attitude, which is just great. No other animal likes to go out there and smell and please its owners and its handlers, in other words, humans, the way dogs do.
One of the most fascinating pieces about your article was how a dog's sense of smell works so differently than, say, a human's. Can you talk through what they're doing differently?
Oh, boy. It's a much different smelling machine than ours is. For one thing, much more of a dog's brain is devoted to processing odor information, if you will. I believe that the figure that I quote in the piece is that they have an olfactory area that's 40 times greater than a human. They have about 300 million olfactory cells. We have about 6 million. And whereas we've got about 5% of our brains figuring out what's going on there olfactorily, if that's a word, a dog really is spending a little bit more than a third of its brain resources processing smells and figuring out what they mean. So really, smell for a dog is where it's at.
And it's a different picture, too, when you're a dog. I think you use the example of spaghetti sauce. I smell spaghetti sauce, and I'm saying, hey, that's spaghetti sauce. A dog smells it, and it's sorting the different component smells, right?
That's right. I mean, that was the analogy that one of the trainers at MSA used, and I think it's a very good one. It makes things very clear. Whereas we might smell an odor as really the sum of its component parts, the dog functions by breaking that odor down into, in fact, its component parts. So using the spaghetti sauce analogy, the dog's nose is saying, aha, that's garlic, that's oregano, that's tomato, that's thyme, and is not really saying that's tomato sauce. I mean, it would be up to a human to say that's tomato sauce, or in the case of a bomb, aha, that's a bomb.
Yeah, let's now substitute the bomb ingredients, I guess, for the ingredients we use to cook. What is a dog's nose looking for, and I guess how do you train the dog to recognize that?
Well, the training is a little bit as you might expect. I went up to the training facility, which is up outside of Hartford, Connecticut, and it's a big row of cans. I don't remember exactly how many, but it's about 30-odd cans by 20-odd cans. And some of them are filled with the ingredients that the dog is being trained to recognize, and these would be the most common basic components of bombs. I mean, there are about 5 different families of explosives out there, so they don't really recognize each and every bomb per se, but all of these elements are contained in most of your bombs, and they include TNT, water gel, commercial dynamite. There's something called RDX that is used in C4 and Semtex. So these chemical components are placed in the cans. The dog will be walked up and down the rows of the cans, and when he or she smells one of these components, he's trained to sit down and just wait there. The only signal he's trained to make is to sit down. If it's the right can, he's rewarded. In the case of a Labrador, that might be food. In the case of a German Shepherd, that might be a tennis ball. But through that kind of Pavlovian repetition, the dogs are trained then to respond when they come across one of these odors.
And the sitting there is a key. You don't want the dog getting excited, I imagine, and trying to get at whatever it's sniffing.
Boy, do you not. If there's any kind of natural instinctive dog reaction to yelp or paw or otherwise make a fuss, you want that trained out of the dog.
And once the dogs get their training, where do they go into employment? I assume airports leaps to mind as an example for me. How common are they at airports, and where else are they?
Well, dog use, explosive dog detection use has ballooned since 9/11, and they're really in use in various settings, kind of divided between public and private. They're certainly used in homeland security kinds of settings, airports, bus stations, public areas, by various governmental agencies. They're of course used overseas in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other theaters of conflict, and they're used very much, and I think this is the mainstay of MSA's operation, if not the mainstay, certainly a prime component, in private institutions, mostly financial institutions, because if you get a bomb threat and you have to shut down your offices and stop, say, trading for an hour or so while you check out that threat or more, it's tremendously costly. So you want a dog both to prevent that if it occurs and to deter it if it doesn't occur.
Hey, given the security nature of this, was it hard to get access to this place? Did they want a reporter nosing around on the premises?
Well, in fact, MSA was very open, but there was a lot they couldn't talk about. And as far as their clients went, I mean, I tried to and did speak to some of their clients, but as far as identifying them or giving out any details of how they use the dogs, in what setting, anything that could be a tip-off to somebody who is thinking of calling in a bomb threat to this institution, that was completely off-limits. Hmm.
What kind of breeds? You mentioned German Shepherds and Labs. Why those, and are there other breeds that go through this training and are commonly used?
Well, those are the most popular ones. I was fascinated to learn. Labradors are great just because they are so anxious to please. They have a great work ethic. They just kind of love to do what they do. And German Shepherds as well. For them, it's just a big game. It's all play. Of course, one is inclined to ask about bloodhounds, which at least have the reputation as being the best smellers in the canine universe. And one of the MSA people who had used bloodhounds when he was a Connecticut State Patrolman told me that it's great if you're chasing a convict, say, or need the dog to go in a straight line, but if you need a dog that's intelligent, you do not want to employ a bloodhound, which apparently is quite stupid and smells terrible to boot.
Huh.
So they're off. Golden Retrievers are great and are fantastic smellers, but the problem with Golden Retrievers is that they're so intelligent that if they're feeling finicky and just don't feel like working that day, they're capable of saying the hell with it. I'm not doing this job.
So are we actually catching bombs by having these dogs in place at the institutions you talked about?
That's a good question. The short answer is no. The longer answer is everybody's fine with that, because if you catch a bomb, it means somebody set the bomb, and nobody's really wild about that. There is ample evidence that dogs do catch bombs. Certainly overseas, they catch bombs all the time. But there actually have been no cases of dogs in this country actually catching a bomb that would have wreaked havoc somewhere in the United States. The one exception to that is the first bomb dog, or one of the first bomb dogs, who was really part of a demonstration project at Kennedy Airport when somebody called in a threat. And they grounded all the planes and pulled planes back that were already in the air. And the dog just happened to be on the scene, was brought onto one of the TWA flights, and did, in fact, find the bomb that was on the plane. Apart from that, no bombs in the States.
Is there a sense that maybe there's a deterrent effect, that this the mystique of the bomb-sniffing dog makes someone less likely to try to smuggle one aboard?
Oh, very much so. I mean, they're employed for that reason. In fact, the people who use the dogs, people who train the dogs, people who use the dogs would be perfectly happy if they never find a bomb. And the people who employ the dogs would be perfectly happy as well if all the dog was doing was kind of making it less likely that somebody would either call in a threat or set the bomb in the first place.
Now, how about after retirement? The life doesn't sound so bad for dogs at airports, but dogs on battlefields, that's got to be traumatic. Do they come back and life gets a little better for them?
Well, I mean, we're starting to see, and the evidence of this is still a bit hazy, but veterinarians have been starting to see dogs coming back with what they're calling canine PTSD. There aren't that many cases, but they end up being somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% of dogs that are in combat. And nobody knows really how to diagnose this. They're really at the outset of trying to learn more about it. But dogs will come back. Some of them will just be kind of vaguely catatonic. Others of them will be extremely jumpy and just like a human, any kind of bomb-like noise or any kind of loud noise, period, the dog will start whimpering and cowering. So they've found that they've had some success in trying to treat canine PTSD, and they send the dogs back into combat when they do. But there are about half the cases where the dog just is that's the end of that dog's working life. And I guess the lucky thing it is for the dog.
Joshua, thanks so much for joining us today. Very interesting.
My pleasure.
That's Joshua Levine. His piece, The Education of a Bomb Dog, was in Smithsonian Magazine.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to Wisconsin legend and Dukes of Hazzard star Tom Wopat about his new album and how growing up in Wisconsin affected his career.
We'll talk to a guest about the last holdout for typewriters.
And we'll talk about the roots and evolution of the jam music scene.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a former Bodine's Band member about a play he's working on. It's set to open in Milwaukee tomorrow. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The song we're listening to is one from the Wisconsin band The Bodines that was released in 1986.
A former member of The Bodines, Sam Yannis, is back in his hometown of Milwaukee this coming weekend performing a play called A Day for Grace with actor and playwright Doug Vincent.
The play combines Sam's music with Doug's script and deals with suicide, something that both artists have dealt with in their lives.
The play opens tomorrow at the Next Act Theater in Milwaukee, runs until September 8th.
Sam Yannis and Doug Vincent are with us now from our studio in Milwaukee to talk about their collaboration. And Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
And Doug, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Yes, thanks so much for having us.
And Doug, I want to talk to you. This play is one that deals with some pretty tough stuff, including some things that we generally don't like to look too closely at, including suicide and addiction. Can you tell us a bit about where this play came from for you?
Yes, I can. As you mentioned, it does kind of tackle issues that sometimes folks have trouble approaching. And we feel like with this project that Sam and I ended up collaborating on and bringing together, that we were able to tackle some issues such as alcoholism and depression and even suicide. And the genesis of the original story is it's an autobiographical play, and it's it involves my true story of losing my dad to suicide, and kind of as a result of his battles with alcoholism and depression. But it's also a story of hope and perseverance and overcoming adversity as well with the birth of my daughter, Grace.
And the birth of your daughter, Grace, that's a story unto itself. That was obviously something that happened a lot farther down the road. Was it tough to go back and look at this stuff again after, you know, having survived it once?
That's a good question. And interestingly, in the creative process for me, even before I kind of got with Sam and Gary, his producer, Gary Tannen, I was originally writing the show fundamentally about my dad's darker story, obviously. And in the course of that creative process, in the course of that writing that script, my daughter Grace was born, and she kind of found her way into the story unbeknownst to me. It was unplanned. It was a happy accident, her birth. And the details of that story and that birth mirrored and paralleled the darker side of that overall story with my dad's death in such compelling ways that Grace found her way into the script.
Now, Sam, this was all going on, and you were approached, you know, after you had dealt with some similar things, but quite a bit afterwards. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this play.
Well, this is a very modern kind of story in the sense that Doug got a hold of us only about less than two years ago, you know, a year and a half about through the internet. You know, he contacted us about using some music for this play that he was doing. And I thought, and I think that even he thought, that he was just maybe going to use a couple of pre-recorded songs maybe at the beginning or at the end or something like that. And at first, you know, we didn't know if this guy was just some kook. You know, you never know who's contacting you these days. You know, so we asked him to send the script along, and he did. And once you know, we got to look at the script. You know, it seemed apparent that he was for real, and this was something that was obviously well thought out and well written. And so we agreed to meet him. So we met in Albuquerque, where he was working with a director, his director at the time. And I guess before that, you know, once we realized what the script was about, we told him that that he should listen to a record that I put out in 1998 called "A Good Day to Die," which was my response to my brother's suicide, which happened a long time ago. And he didn't know that record existed.
Hmm.
And so when we got together in Albuquerque, it was just really remarkably fantastic how almost scene for scene what he had written mirrored almost song for song what I had written like 15 years earlier.
Wow.
And so we got together like that, and it just really fell together very quickly somehow.
So it must have healed something or tapped into something in both of you, both having had suicide in your past within your own family. And it's an incredible thing to go through when you're young, and it must have bonded you together somehow.
Yeah, you know, that's true. But, you know, I didn't really know what to expect from any of this. And we just sort of were taking it, you know, one step at a time. And every step we took, it just seemed like this is something that somehow we're supposed to be doing it. It seemed right. It seemed natural. And the way it just all came together so easily, it just, you know, we just wanted to take it to the next step. You know, and that's what we've been doing.
And Sam, you play a song during the show that you wrote 15 years ago. It's one you just talked about, and it's called "A Good Day to Die." Let's take a listen to it. Both of you have turned to music and art to cope with suicide. Doug, does using and having that outlet of art, has that helped you through what was a difficult passage for you?
Absolutely. It's such a difficult, taboo subject. Really publicly, of course, but even personally, it's difficult to be able to access in a true way those areas of what you've actually unexpectedly experienced. So I think that when we have challenges like that that are as difficult as those experiences, for me, I almost needed some sort of entryway to be able to explore it personally, truly and fully. And artistically, I feel like that gave me a door to be able to open it up in a safe way and be able to explore those emotions in a way that was true for me. And I have to say too, of course, with Sam's involvement in the project, the way he brings so many more layers of depth with the musical elements intertwined with the monologues, it opens that door even wider from my experience.
And Sam, what would you say to that? How has using art and music helped you cope?
Well, you know, when I started writing songs, I always knew that I would write about, you know, my brother's suicide one day. And it took a while, you know, and then one day it just sort of came out. And it just really was a way to kind of exorcise some demons and kind of, you know, you can't ever really get closure on something like that because, you know, you don't know why it happened. You know, I don't know why my brother killed himself, and I'm never going to know why, you know, but this was as close as I could come to just sort of kind of expressing kind of what happened and how I felt about it. And it was just a way to just sort of, you know, help myself deal with it and just kind of, you know, kind of get as much closure as I could, I guess.
And Doug, I'm curious about how the music functions in this play. You spoke of it as a door to go through. And so you've got these dramatic monologues that you do. And it's funny, too. I want to stress that there's a lot of humor in this play as well. But
yeah, thank you.
How does the music come in, and how does it work within the fabric of the play?
Well, that was an interesting experience artistically as well. I have to say I've never really experienced or seen a show quite like this, where naturally and organically it came together, where the music intertwines in a new way for this type of show, or really any type of show I've experienced, where essentially as I'm going through a monologue, doing my stories, Sam will be providing incredible textured musical underscore, which then often will lead into kind of an ebb and flow from my monologue into his songs, and then it kind of ebbs and flows back again. I feel like pretty organically, where it'll flow back into the next monologue and the next story. So it really kind of is a new manifestation of this type of autobiographical show, originally a one-man autobiographical show, that's since grown into this two-man collaboration that's I feel, truly creatively unique.
So like we said, there's a lot of difficult stuff. There's suicide in here and addiction, but there's moments of light too. And the birth of your daughter Grace, as we talked about, that's one of them. And we actually have a clip from that scene. And first we're going to hear a monologue by Doug, and then Sam is going to come in on the guitar. And this is going to give us a sense of that texture that we're talking about.
The angle she comes out, she's exactly in line with me. Her eyes are wide open and directly meet mine. Her eyes are wide open, filled with fear. And the doctor awkwardly struggles to get that cord off, wrapped around her neck tight like a noose. She's breathing. She's breathing.
You have a healthy three-year-old with you now, I know. We're talking right now with singer and songwriter Sam Yamas and playwright Doug Vincent about their collaboration on the play A Day for Grace, which opens in Milwaukee tomorrow at the Next Act Theater.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with more from Sam and Doug. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We're back now with singer and songwriter Sam Yamas, formerly of the Bodines, and playwright Doug Vincent. And we're talking about their collaboration on the play A Day for Grace, which opens in Milwaukee tomorrow at the Next Act Theater. And we heard a very emotional clip about the birth of your daughter Grace as we went into that last break there. But as we talked about, there's a lot of laughter that happened here, too. And some of the clips that I saw online, give your audiences in stitches. Was this was this a fun play to work on too, even though it was tough in some ways, Sam?
Absolutely, because you know Doug is a very talented comedian, and so I had a few apprehensions about going into this, like, well, what is this kind of just a suicide ride, and you know, I don't know if people are going to be ready for that, but you know, as it unfolded, you know, you're right, there is a lot of, it's infused with a lot of humor. And so that was a relief, and I think that people, you know, I mean, they need that at certain points. It's, you know, they can't just we're trying to present some serious issues to people, but you just can't do that. You have to find a way where, you know, it's digestible for people, and Doug really has done a great job with that.
Doug, can you tell us about some of the lighter moments in the play?
Yes, one moment that I look forward to each night is a monologue I do about my childhood hero, Johnny Bench, who was a catcher for the Cincinnati Reds that I worshipped when I was a kid. And that's one of those stories that I enjoy bringing out there for the audience each night. As Sam says, particularly when you're tackling these sorts of subjects, it really requires some levity as well. And truth be told, that humor comes from necessity, from those darker places for me personally and a lot of other folks that I know who do more of the comedic work out there, where it's really kind of coming from some of those places and that need for levity from difficult circumstances sometimes.
Well, I suppose it's true to life too, because, you know, no life, even no matter how dark, is without some moments where you have to laugh even though things are bad.
Right. That's right.
What do audiences respond to the most after they see this play, Doug?
You know, the most interesting thing to me in my experience with audience reaction is how open folks have been to be able to come along for the experiences that we're kind of bringing them to here with the show and the play and the stories. And probably the most surprising piece of that is the breadth of the audience reaction. All sorts of folks across the spectrum respond in a big way. All kinds of different folks really have been able to come along with us, and that's a very encouraging thing to me. It's our hope to be able to open that door as it opened for me personally. It's ultimately not about me, and the hope is to be able to open it, that door, for folks across the spectrum.
Yeah, it seems like as a society we're kind of moving toward being more open about suicide and depression and addiction, but, you know, we're definitely not all the way there yet. And Sam, do you see some of those doors opening up as you perform?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, the time has really come for people are a lot more ready to, discuss these sorts of things, and they're open to, being presented something like this. You know, I think it's sort of been locked down for a long time, and so many people are touched by these problems that, we're really just trying to say, hey, you know, you're not alone, you know, and it's okay to feel that way. And there's some value in talking about it and reaching out to maybe somebody else who might understand where you're coming from, because they're out there.
Do people tell you your story, their own stories, I should say, after they've seen this? Does it kind of open the floodgates?
A bit, you know. I don't get to talk to that many people, but I think that's what people are being drawn to, is like, hey, you know, I'm not alone, and maybe I can go there and find, you know, some kindred spirit somehow and have some sort of outlet.
Now, Doug, we talked earlier about how you approached Sam to provide the music in this play. So how psyched were you when you got to work with him and he said yes?
Oh, I'm incredibly appreciative for Sam to be open to give that script a shot and see what I kind of had going there. And it is absolutely a great honor to be able to perform with them each night. I pinch myself being able to go up there and do the show with Sammy.
Now, were you a fan from the Bodine's years, or had you been following the whole trajectory of Sam's career?
I primarily was a fan of Sam's through the Bodine's and had gone to a lot of live shows, particularly, which was kind of the original draw for me to approach him. I just had this sense from the live experience of seeing him as an audience member, of course, that man, I feel like this guy is he's gonna get it if I'm able to maybe get in touch with him and have him take a look at what I'm doing here.
What was it about his music that made you think that? Was it just a presence he had or a gut feeling?
It's a gut feeling. It absolutely was an instinct and a gut feeling. And again, particularly from the experience of seeing him live, Sam is so adept at being able to connect with you soul to soul as an audience member to a performer. That was incredibly compelling and triggered that instinct in me.
And Sam, has the experience for you made you feel like you might want to do more on the stage or more work with suicide prevention?
Well, you know, I never thought I would be doing anything like this. You know, I never had any idea that anything like this would present itself. So I've been enjoying it, you know, a great deal. And I certainly would be open to doing, you know, more work like this. But we're here and we like to take it one day at a time, you know, as they say. So, you know, I mean, obviously we do want to be able to present this play to a lot more people in a lot more cities. And that's really the goal here. But you know, and we're going to New York, you know, towards that end. But like I say, we're just taking it slow, and you know, hopefully those opportunities will arise. But that has to be seen, I guess.
Well, we have one more clip that we'll be going out with. But I wonder if you could set it up for us and talk a little bit about it first. Sam, the song is called "The Way Home."
Well, I think in this part of the play, Doug is flashing back, you know, to an earlier time when him and Jessica, before they were married. And once again, he's, you know, dealing with some demons of rage that he feels. And, you know, he's wondering, he's questioning whether he's going to be able to suppress these things when his daughter is born, and even towards his wife, I think. And I come in with a song that just talks about, like, you know, your family and feelings of connection and wanting to make a stronger connection. I think, you know, the way home is, you know, sort of a metaphor for, you know, your true self, and you're trying to find your way there, you know, your whole life, I think.
Excellent. And Doug, do you want to add anything to that?
I think Sam captured that well. I would probably just add that at that scene in towards the end of the show too, Sam's song is so eloquent in capturing not only the scene just previous to it, but it almost kind of wraps up a lot of things in the whole show.
All right, well, let's take a listen to that as we go out here. And Sam and Doug, I want to wish you both well with this. Appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you so much.
Yes, thanks so much for having us.
We've been speaking with singer-songwriter Sam Yanas and playwright Doug Vinson about their collaboration on the play A Day for Grace. It's playing at Milwaukee's Next Act Theater from September 5th through 8th.
Up next is the news, then we'll hear about a new CDC study out today that puts a number on how many heart disease-related deaths are preventable each year in the United States. This is Central Time, and we'll go out with that song from the musical, the play we've been talking about. On the way home. On the way home.
Just a child and I was walking. I was learning how to grow every day. On the way home. On the way home. Now looking at my life, I can see the mistakes. Which way to understanding and forgiveness on the way home, on the way home.